This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Slideshow photographs has whet your appetite enough. I've certainly excitedly gushed enough, because this man surely needs no introduction. In conversation with Julia Wheeler, please welcome Michael Palin.
Hi, thank you. Hello.
Thank you. Wow. How lovely to see quite so many people out here. Well done for getting huddled and squished and squashed in.
Why aren't you all out travelling?
Well, what a finale to the first day's festival. Michael's here to tell us about some of his stories, his motivations, his memories and so on. And on television and on the page, he's taken us around the world in 80 days, from pole to pole, in a full circle, across the Sahara, up the Himalayas, through New Europe, and on a zigzag of Brazil.
I wondered how you're going to get Brazil in there.
It is quite a zigzag. So it's perhaps interesting to look back, and thought-provoking to look back, in thinking that actually, no offence, but you weren't the first choice for around the world in 80 days, were you?
Well, I didn't know that at the time. I thought I was.
I haven't just broken it to you now, have I?
No. Well, no, it happened a long time ago. And the truth was broken to me in the port of Chennai in India, which is was Madras, now Chennai. And I was talking to our director, and we'd had a few beers, and you know, I said it's just so nice. It's such a great break to do a show like this. I just don't know why they thought of me, but I'm just so delighted that they chose me. He said, well, actually, you were the fifth person they thought about. So there we go. Even Noel Edmonds had turned it down.
So, there we go. And thank goodness.
Oh, well, no.
So you're obviously the front man of this crew, but tell us about how the rest of the crew was chosen and a little bit about the relationships between them and how you all got on.
Well, the crew were chosen by a man called Clem Vallance, who was the guy who came up with the idea of Around the World in 80 Days. And there was a cameraman called Nigel Meakin, who's about 3 or 4 years younger than me, and he ended up as the cameraman on all the rest of the journeys. I love working with a team of good people, and once you've got that team, staying with them, and we tried to do that as much as possible. Nigel stayed throughout 9 series. We had about 2 or 3 different sound recordists. The important thing was to get a few people doing their job really well, rather than a lot of people sort of deluging an area. We had to have a very discreet presence and a very light footfall, because you're going to places where you just wanted people to tell their story, to open up, to not feel sort of cowed, to have to answer 10 questions about the world situation, about food or the environment or anything like that. Just observe their way of life. And so it was very, very important that the crew were all people who understood how to do that. And they were very, very discreet about it. And Nigel was absolutely brilliant. That was a good story I can tell. Any children in the audience? No, it's not too bad. But I remember we were in a small Chinese village, and we just arrived that morning and didn't know quite what was going to go on. And they were this is right in the middle of the countryside. And they said, well, we have some of the elders are going to be gathered in the hut over there having a little drink. And so perhaps you can go and talk to them. And the director then said to me, oh, Michael, before you go into the hut to talk to them, just look around at the village a bit. Nigel will follow you, and you'll have a look around. And so I looked around and found the village incredibly fascinating. And I completely forgot about Nigel. And suddenly I heard this, it doesn't say very much, Nigel. He said, get into the fucking hut! And I realised that I'd been taken for granted that I was being followed by someone who was having to hold this very, very heavy camera on his shoulder. And it also, you know, I mean, it's... there were some wonderful moments. The cameraman has to be incredibly prehensile and be able to fold himself up Houdini-like in the... You know, we'd be doing a shot, I'd be driving along, and he'd be crouched down there with the camera going up like that. And so, you know, we we had a very good time together, and we would always sort of at the end of the day be amazed that we'd survived that day and we got what we got, because we did work very, very fast. You had to. A lot of these places, if you're moving on a journey, you know you're never going to come back there. And in that day, you have to get whatever you can from this situation. People speaking a totally different language, different customs, different way of life. You've got to somehow get something of that before the end of the day. So it's a bit like a sort of little commando unit.
It's quite pressured.
Yeah, it was quite pressured. I enjoyed that.
But then the tension is that you need to make it look not quite so pressured and quite... I mean, you do make it look very laid back on screen for most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I didn't let the fear show. Not that it was fear exactly, but I did let the wonder show, and that's very, very important. If you approach it rather as though, oh, I know what to do here, I'm a professional presenter, I've done all this before, I know where to stand, where to go, then I think people would notice that. I was just going to places and seeing them very much for the first time, which is an interesting point, because the director and his assistant used to have to go out ahead of me to just make sure that trains ran at certain places, there was a hotel we could stay in, just roughly plot the route. And I never went on any of those recces, because I thought it was very important for me to see things on camera for the first time. So it was that sense of wonder that kept me going, and bewilderment. And I felt comfortable about that early on when we started doing the journey. I thought, what is a presenter? How do I do presenting? You know, sort of John Simpson, people like that, they're presenters and they know where to stand and what to do. And I realised pretty soon into the journey that I was better just going along with the flow, talking to people, engaging with people. And the fact I didn't know what I was doing didn't particularly matter. And it made it look real. And so I was safe in the sense. I could look confused, but reap the benefits of looking confused.
There's wonder and bewilderment there, but there's also a vast respect for the people that you're meeting. Because it's quite a thin line between, isn't this strange, and this is normality for these people. How did you walk that tightrope?
I always thought that we were the strange ones. You know, have to think, you know, they're not strange. They live in a Chinese village. They live in a Patagonian village. They live in a Mongolian yurt or whatever. That's where they live. That's their land. We are the strange ones who come along. So you have to just remember that and not assume that they think you're the norm, because you're not. They're the norm. We had a very, very important member of our team was a fixer, was a local person, and they could make or break a film, because they had to know enough about the people. They didn't, you know, you had to avoid them bringing you people from the tourist board or the government to give their point of view. So they had to have our view of it, which was just we wanted to talk to the ordinary people. And they perhaps want you to see a particular temple or a spectacular building. We said, no, we'd like to see these people having their hair cut or whatever. And they would then have to negotiate with the people, and they'd have to get the pitch right, and they'd have to be able to explain to them what we were doing and make them feel relaxed and all that. Although I have to say, most people in the world are incredibly relaxed.
Compared to us.
Very, very, yes. Yeah. Very, very few people seem to be at all worried. They were slightly mystified by what we were all doing. But they were very natural on the whole.
And presumably that's become easier to explain to people because you've got, you know, when people go to pitch, because they might have seen what's come before. Whereas around the world in 80 days, it was a new kind of travel. It was a new premise altogether.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing was that most of the places we visited in the world didn't show the series. So, you know, no one in Pakistan particularly or Eritrea would have seen the preceding series. So no one knew that I was a famous traveller. They were told occasionally I was a famous traveller. And once I was recognised, quite bizarrely, in a small island called Little Diomede, which is between Alaska and America and the Bering Strait, right on the international date line.
So this was in...
This was Full Circle.
Full Circle, okay.
And it was our first day's filming on Full Circle. Oh. And I did a whole piece to camera about we're going around the world, blah, blah, blah. And these local Inuit were sort of a bit bewildered. And as we walked down to the jetty where they'd supplied a boat, a sealskin boat for us. Three of these, the older members of the group, sort of were following and kind of looking at me in a slightly more respectful way. And I thought, what's going on here? You know, and we got to the boat, and finally one of them came forward and said, "Hey, aren't you the guy from Monty Python and the Holy Grail?" So, they'd just seen that the night before, you know, bounced off from some Alaskan television station. So there we are. But there are other moments which are not so good. I've just very quickly, on recognition, we were in Nepal. We were climbing up Annapurna, the Annapurna base camp. And it was a tough climb, and I had a cold when it started. And we were going up and up, and there was less and less air to breathe. And it was really very, very painful. And I got to the bottom of a long flight of steps, and I thought, oh, my God, you know, I've got to get up all these. Worse still, there were two ladies at the top in sort of anoraks who sort of looked down. One nudged the other and sort of pointed. And I thought, oh, God. So I did my very best to straighten myself up, blow my nose and walked up. And as I walked past them, I heard one say to the other, "Oh, my God, it's Eric Idle." So, you know, recognition has not really been a great problem.
So I guess recognition, it would open doors. But one thing that it doesn't necessarily help with is dangerous situations. Has there ever been a moment on your travels where you've thought, this is not looking good, this could be it?
Well, a number of those occasions were actually not captured on film. They tended to be in small aircraft in storms somewhere. But I do remember with Pole to Pole, we had to film at the North Pole, and to get to the North Pole it either takes 2 years, which you didn't have, or you fly there. And we flew to where the North Pole is, you know, it's a sort of moving ice, really. It's not a, there's not a landmass there, as everybody knows. And we got to 90 degrees and looked down, and there was this big ice floe, and The pilots of this twin-engine prop plane started to go down, heading for what is really a moving airport. It's actually moving as you go towards it, and probably melting at the same time, because this was quite late in the year. And as we got down, they suddenly aborted the landing and flew up. And my heart was thudding. Badly enough anyway, and I said, what's the problem? They said, sunshine. And I said, sunshine? I mean, that's lovely.
They
said, no, we've got to wait for more sunshine so that we can see the ridges on the ice. There isn't enough at the moment. We've got to wait. So we circled around, went down another time, aborted again. By this time, I was a gibbering idiot. And I noticed there was some splits in some of the ice floes. And on the third time, they said, oh, well, let's go anyway. Oh. Which is sort of the worst thing, you know? The three words you just don't want to hear when you're in trouble. And we did land, and it was actually Nigel did film it. And it looks as if the whole plane is contracting and expanding. It's an extraordinary effect. The whole thing seems to wobble and bend. Mm. And we got down, and I've never been so relieved in my life. And I did think, as we sort of went into our third descent, I shouldn't have done this. This is not fair on my family, my children, my friends. This is irresponsible and stupid. And Pole to Pole, we could have called it Peterborough to the Pole and started somewhere, you know, reasonably where you could at least land. But in the end, of course, it was great that we did it that way.
And it didn't stop you having other adventures after that. So no. There sort of is a momentary, I shouldn't have done this, but then it's dissipates.
Oh, yes, I mean, then...
enthusiasm.
Then, I mean, this was... actually, when we left our floating ice floe, we were supposed to go to Spitsbergen, to the Svalbard Islands, and the weather was so bad there that we were diverted to a Danish air base in northern Greenland called Thul. And this was quite an interesting moment, because we landed in the middle of the night, and there were just some young Danish soldiers there, and someone had read ahead and said, oh, there's a plane emergency, can you give them some room for the night? And so we went and banged on the door of a hut, and you know, the director went in and the assistant went in, Nigel went in, and as I started to go in, this huge, tall Danish sort of marine the colour drained out of his face. He went absolutely white and began to sort of slightly shake, and come looked at me, and so he said, yes, go in. And we went in, and there I saw on the table a DVD of Monty Python, which he must have been watching quite recently. Just couldn't believe. In the north of Greenland, in walks one of the members of the Python team. And apparently he had a nervous breakdown, had to be sent back to Copenhagen. I made that bit up. I didn't make up the first bit. But then the journey after that to the Svalbard, we had to go, and we got into a very, very heavy storm. And you couldn't really see anything around the plane at all. And we weren't filming. It was just fun. And suddenly we broke out of the cloud, and the North Atlantic, the stormy white-capped waters of the North Atlantic, were about 25 feet below us. And, oh, God, no, again. So the great thing is you don't expect these things, and I'm an optimist. I always think everything's going to be okay. So it's not quite so bad. Don't lose so many nights' sleep in advance. Mm. But, yeah, there were some hairy moments.
You talk about Monty Python. I mean, one thing that really comes through in the diaries from that time is the fact that you had this sort of embarrassment of riches at the time that you started on Polterpole, because you had that comedic background. You could have done this, you could have done that. When was it and how was it that you continued down the travel path rather than any of the other wonderful options that you might have had?
You see, I think the travel path predated Monty Python. The travel path, I can remember when I was a schoolboy in Sheffield. I just loved geography. I loved getting out of school. I loved sort of walking up rivers to the mountains, into the Peak District. I loved getting away. And apparently my mother said that when I was a very, very small baby and I would be put outside the house in my pram, I hated the pram being stuck in one place. And I would do various things like take all my clothes off till someone had to come out, because it was quite cold in Sheffield at the time of year, put the clothes back on, then walk me somewhere. So even then, I think I had a desire to move and see places. And, you know, throughout my childhood, I never expected to leave Sheffield particularly, except in my mind through books, through stories, through National Geographic magazine, all those sort of things. So travel was there somehow. I just never really thought I'd ever see any of these places as I read about in the Biggles books, the Gobi Desert and all that. And but it was there. It must be a sort of just suppressed. And then, even with Monty Python, we, Terry Jones and myself, were the two who wanted to get out of London. I mean, John and Graham were quite happy to film everything in a studio near their homes. And Terry and I said, no, let's why don't we go up to Yorkshire and we can get these fantastic landscapes and we can film sort of epics and all that. And so we filmed, like, the Holy Grail was all shot in Scotland, mainly because Terry and I said, everything's there. We've got the landscape, it's for free and all that. So even then we were travelling. But I didn't expect to be asked to get back to where we started, to be asked by the BBC to go around the world in 80 days. That really seemed completely out of the blue. But maybe it wasn't. Maybe they sensed something in me, or I'd given off some strange sort of travel pheromones.
One of the most memorable segments for me, and perhaps other people in the audience, is that wonderful Dow trip that you made from Dubai to then Bombay, now Mumbai. Mm. Why was that? I mean, it's palpable on when you watch the programme again. Why was that so special for you?
Because it was completely unexpected and unexplored territory. What had happened was that, in keeping with following the Phileas Fogg story, a dhow had been sort of secured, but was from Oman. And, you know, they'd got it all worked out. We were in Jeddah, and everything went wrong. The ship that was supposed to take us around the Arabian Peninsula didn't turn up at the right time. It didn't turn up the next day. And we kept asking, is this ship coming? He said, oh, yeah, it's coming. It's just to be a little while. The next day, is it coming? Yes, it'll probably come later today. And then the day after that, it wasn't there. I said, is it coming? No, it's burnt out. It blew up and it's all burnt out. So never coming. So panic stations. I had to obey the rules of the journey and travel overland. So myself and the director got permission to travel by car right across Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, the rest of the crew flew to Dubai, where they were told the Oman dhow had gone. Flew to Dubai, where they managed to secure a dhow. We got there. The dhow was... the crew was 18 Gujarati fishermen, who, none of whom spoke English. The captain spoke a little bit of English. And they'd never done anything like this before. And we just had to go for it. And there was no, we no, had no sat phones at that time. There's no way of contacting the rest of the world. We were out of touch. We were on a ship that would go at best 3.5 knots, very slowly down the Gulf. And I mean, there were no sort of sleeping berths or anything like that. We all lived on deck, the 18 fishermen and the five or six of us in the crew. And gradually, we got a sort of modus vivendi, which worked out really well. And they were terribly nice to us. And we had got some food from Sainsbury's, which we were going to eat. Yes, we managed to bring that. Oh, we can't eat that foreign muck. And
okay,
somewhat,
what was still in your pack from Sainsbury's when you got to Dubai?
Well, there was a tuna.
Tuna?
A big tuna sort of
tin.
Steak. Yeah,
steak.
It wasn't minced tuna, it was a right. tuna steak. Okay. And we opened that and it flap, went flop onto the plate and sort of lay there panting like a sort of heart that had recently been removed. And nobody wanted to eat that apart from the sound man who just didn't like foreign food, period. And they just said, look, we're making some curry. We will share it with you. And so they shared their curry with us. And day by day, we got to know them. And they became, you know, not just our friends, but the people whom we absolutely depended on. They may have been the most basic form of marine technology, but it had worked for hundreds of years. The dhows were exactly the same shape as the dhows had gone down the coast of Africa and all that. And they knew how to sail them. And so we depended on them, and we gradually kind of made friends with them. And this very old guy called Kasim, say very old, he's probably the age I am now, but he was all white beard and all that. And he was fascinated by my Walkman. I had a little Sonny Walkman at the time. And he wanted to hear what... I was playing some Bruce Springsteen, very early Springsteen, the Wild, the Innocent, and the East Street Shuffle. And he wanted to hear this. And I thought, you're not going to like this, you know. A quiet, elderly Muslim gentleman is not going to want to hear this. And he put it on, and he just started going, ooh, yeah. And then he put his hand up, and so I said, sorry, take it off. He said, no, louder. And I put it louder, and then I put it louder again. And the man's head must have been vibrating with this sort of, you know, American sort of New Jersey rock. And he absolutely loved it. And so we, you know, we learnt things from them, they learnt things from us. And for 7 days, there was this improbable connection between a sort of fairly sort of well-off, high-tech BBC crew and some very poor local fishermen. And we needed them more than they needed us, but we both got on together. And I've never had that ever again. And what it did do is made me realise that presenting wasn't really... a hard job, actually. You just had to listen to people, and you had to be yourself and not try and pretend that you had to always look scrubbed and wear a suit and say your bit. Just go with the flow. And that was what that dhow journey meant for me. Very important.
And it gave you the reputation for being one of the nicest men in Britain. Has that been something that's difficult? Yeah. Is that right?
Yes.
What do you know about me? What do you know about me? Yeah.
Well, let's ask you. Mm. Terry Jones said that he could always tell when you hadn't eaten off screen. Is that a time when things got tense?
That's absolutely true. I do like my food and like them fairly regular meals. And I do get testy if a meal is late. Yes, I'm afraid I do. I don't get unpleasant, but I can be quite argumentative. But I can be argumentative most of the time. Oh. Ask my wife, you know. she alone knows the truth about me, that this nicest man thing has become a bit of a joke, really. It's something you can't live out unless you go and strangle somebody, you know, in plain sight.
To prove them wrong.
And chop them into pieces. Then the people will still say, oh, he's a nice bloke. They'll probably then say, well, you know, he was asking for it. He was asking to be strangled. He'd given Mike a hard time. He'd be very rude. He called him Mick. He doesn't like that.
You did, I think, a brave thing with the dhow crew. in that you went back because it was such a special memory to you, and then you decided to take that risk, really, which could have gone either way. Tell us about when you went back and relived that.
It was the 25th, was it? No, 20th anniversary, I think, of Around the World in 80 Days, and the BBC wanted to mark it in some way. And I thought, well, let's try going back. I don't think it's always a good thing, but I was fascinated by this crew. As I said, we got to know them all very well. What were they all doing now? Where were they? And we found them in a little town called Mandvi, and they'd all done rather well. And the captain was the owner of several ships. The little guy who was then 14, who was the midshipman, was a captain of a very successful dhow, which used to go all the way down to Kenya and all that. Kasim, sadly, had died, and two or three of them weren't particularly well. But it worked a treat, and we got to see them, and I took the tape, and they'd never seen the programme. They'd just never seen the programme. So we all sat down, and we had a look at it together. You know what people are like when they see home, well, that's me doing this, that's me doing that. And it was a very, very good reunion. The only problem was that the captain then took me to one side and said, the BBC promised me a new dhow. I said, really? He said, yes, the BBC promised me a dhow, and it hasn't turned up. I don't want a dhow, just that the money will do. And I just, to this day, don't know what the BBC made that promise. But
did you get that on film?
No, we didn't. No. We didn't actually, no. I didn't have a camera with me at the time. That was one of my private moments. Yeah.
I wonder whether we should get the microphone out, because I can feel there are going to be questions from the audience. The microphone's here. Do stick up your hand if you'd like to ask Michael a question. We'll start over there. Thank you.
Years ago, you used to go around with a canvas bag. And quite literally everywhere, because I came to a book signing in London one year and you still had the bag then. Do you still use it?
Well, I've had everyone hear that about the bag, an intimate question about my canvas bags. I used a canvas bag as a sort of man bag from about 1982, before we did the journeys, actually. And then I found I quite liked them, and they were nice and... They were flexible and bendy, and they look good for when you were in a market or somewhere like that. You couldn't really have a briefcase, and you needed a bag in which I could put my little tape recorder which I had, and also a diary in which I'd note down things I was seeing, because I had to write the book at the end of it. So I had to be doing two things: being on camera and then writing things down. So the bags were very important, and I've had a number of them actually. And yeah, I still use a form of canvas bag, not quite the same, but some very special canvas bags have been created by the company in the Midlands who made my bags, and they are going to be available on my website. I'm sorry, I just
are they called
only
the Palins?
£400? What?
Have they named them the Palin?
Yes, it's something quite subtle. I think the Michael Palin bag. Yes, no, they're special little set they've made. Anyway,
okay.
Thank you. You're not from the bag makers, are you?
Other questions? Let's come to the back. We'll come to you afterwards, okay?
Hi. You had that very memorable interview with the Dalai Lama. Have you got a list of other people you'd like to entertain for tea?
Well, you know, I generally liked the ordinary people I met, really. We used to avoid getting sort of major celebrities, although I did a wonderful interview in Romania with the tennis champion, you know, what's his name? Nastasi, Ile Nastasi. Generally speaking, if you get celebrities, they tend to, for a start, they never turn up on time. It always takes about half an hour. We don't have time for that. And then it's all rather a bit about them rather than, you know, ordinary life. But the Dalai Lama was remarkable. I mean, that was a dream to get to speak to him. And he was so nice. I mean, I don't use the word nice. That's been a bit devalued.
He's nicer than you.
He's nicer than me. Oh, he's absolutely just leagues, but way beyond me in niceness. He's gold, absolute quadruple gold. I mean, he had been talking all that day to people, Tibetan refugees. He'd been meeting people. He had a word for everybody. he'd done about four interviews before he came into the room. The first thing he did when he came into the room was talk to our crew. He didn't talk to me, just shook hands with them all, said hello, welcome. Very nice thing. And my great sadness was that the interview with him was truncated, and it went on for about 45 minutes. And I feel there should have been more of that, because what was taken out of it was rather sort of just the headline stuff and a lot of nice laughter and all that. But there was more that he said that should have been in. But that's difficult again. If you get somebody major, you can spend a lot of time with. It takes up a lot of the programme. So that's why we tend to just get little clips here and there. But I'm sure there are people I'd like to have spoken to. Beyoncé, probably. No. She wasn't born when we were travelling.
Question here.
Could you tell me which is your favourite travel programme that's on the TV at the moment? And do you plan to do any more travel series yourself?
I don't know of many travel programmes that are on at the moment. I can't give you a sort of completely comprehensive answer. I like Leveson Wood. He's a great traveller. And, of course, you know, I love the Attenborough things. The only thing I miss in those is that there aren't enough people. But, I mean, they are quite brilliant for seeing the world. But I wouldn't do another series like the ones I've done before. I think there's a certain time when you feel, well, you've done all you can. And it's not the fact that there aren't places out there. It's not the fact that I don't want to travel anymore. Quite the opposite. It's just that there are ways and ways of doing things. And television changes. It changes things subtly. For instance, most of the travel programmes we did were sort of, we'd be commissioned to do six, and we'd suddenly find we've got material for seven. So, oh, yes, you'll do seven, or eight, and then nine, and one of them is even ten. BBC now would be very strict in saying there are three programmes, or four at the most, and that is as much as they'll commission. So the idea of just rambling off around the world and doing a long journey, which you add to week after week, wouldn't be possible anymore. So I think that's something that would make me sort of stop. But also I think I like to do other things and other challenges.
Like what? What are you up to at the moment?
Well, I'm actually writing a book about a ship called HMS Erebus, which was a small ship, modest, tough little ship that was involved in two of the most significant polar journeys of the early 19th century, once to the Antarctic, one to the Antarctic, where it went further south than anybody had been before, a sailing ship going in amongst the icebergs, and the other, the John Franklin expedition to the Northwest Passage in 1845, which was a complete disaster, and everyone was lost, no one knew what had happened to them, everything disappeared, and that was the Erebus's sort of fate was, no one knew what had happened until 2.5 years ago when the hull of the ship was found in Canadian waters in the Arctic. And so the ship is sort of still under the water, well preserved. And I just wanted to write a story about that period, seen almost through the eyes of a ship. But I've only been on it for a month, so I don't know.
And do you plan to travel there and see that?
Yeah. So I'll go to some of the sites, certainly go to northern Canada. Mm.
Other questions? Let's come here and then come to you afterwards.
Hi. Just wanted to ask, what kind of travelling does Mrs. Palin do?
Very little. Mrs. Palin isn't a great traveller. She likes to go very short distances and then stop. And she's quite happy to be in one place for 3 or 4 hours, you know, or I get a bit restless. But we do go. We enjoy our breaks together. We go on holiday with the children and the grandchildren once a year to sunny Mallorca. Helen and I will go to a city, you know, try somewhere in Europe, Barcelona, Antwerp, somewhere that's sort of interesting. We go for 2 or 3 days. But no, she's not a long distance traveller at all, which actually. I was incredibly fortunate that she's not, because otherwise I think it would have been quite difficult. She would have felt very jealous of me going off around the world. Whereas, as it was, you know, I'd say, oh, darling, I'm not going to see you for 6 months. She'd say, oh, great, all right. off you go. Don't expect me to come. So it made it all easier, actually. Anyway, I'll tell her you were asking afterwards.
Hello. I've got quite a lot of your books, and I love the fact that you put a lot of the comedy from your acting into your programmes. The thing I like, that what I recall, was from Full Circle, when you were arriving in Japan at the customs and explaining the contents of your medicines, having to mime them to them because they couldn't speak the language.
Yes.
Swiftly be moved on for a miming Imodium. What's your favourite comedy moment from your series, all the series?
Favourite comedy moment?
Well, there are quite a lot. I mean, there's a lot of comedy. And people say, why did you give up comedy for travelling? I said, give up comedy. You need comedy. It's a vital, vital part of travel, as it is of life generally. But there was another nice moment of arriving in a place. It was with me and doing Full Circle. And we were arriving at a place called Petropavlovsk, which is in Kamchatka, which is in the very far east of Russia. And there was a welcoming delegation. It was rather, I thought, quite impressive. We came down the steps, and there was a cake, and there were ladies in local dresses and all that. And they all came out, and I said, "Oh yeah." And they went straight past me, and some people were coming down the steps. I just about made for the cake. And it wasn't for me at all. It was for the Minister of the Interior, who'd just come back from a trip to Alaska to try and do some tourism things. And they all danced in. And it's on camera, too, of me saying, this is rather nice. Oh, and cake as well. Thank you very much. Ooh, straight past. I know my place, I felt.
Yes, go ahead.
Would you say it was easier travelling around when you started off doing documentaries around the world? Obviously, the transport was quite limited and would take a lot longer, but you could do things on a whim like the Dow. Or would you say it's easier nowadays where you've got that ease of accessibility, but there's all these crises coming up and visa issues? What would you say comparing between the two?
Well, we had a lot of visa issues. I mean, it was quite... In a sense, until what's happening now in Washington, I mean, it was actually easier, became easier to get around the world. And, you know, some countries, which I don't think I'd be able to go to now, like Pakistan. But on the whole, I preferred it when travel was less high-tech, in an odd way. It's very nice to have a sat phone where you can ring your wife from the Tibetan plateau if you want to, but I liked the feeling of being out of contact in a way. That was kind of what I always, when I was young, I loved the stories of explorers who would go off across the Sahara or Everest or wherever, and Livingstone, people like that, and they were completely out of touch with anybody else, so they had to sort of create their own destiny and make their own sort of way through. And it was nice to feel we could do that, even though we had a crew with us. It was a small crew. Now I think you'll be watched. You'll be on the map wherever you go. I mean, someone up there would know exactly where we were going and what we were doing. And I think that's a shame, really. I think that's really shrunk the world. On the other hand, if you suddenly got ill and sick on a journey, probably much easier now to get help in and take you out and get you to a hospital. So there are pluses and minuses. And the great thing is time can't stand still, things change. But things have changed a lot, I think, since Around the World in 80 Days, in terms of how we travel, the technology, the communications and all that. And I preferred it then.
Question here.
I understand that your early holidays were in the sort of Southwold area in Suffolk, and from what I've heard about them, they didn't seem to be a lot of fun. So I'm a bit surprised that didn't put you off travelling forever. I mean, personally, Sheffield looked more fun than Southwold. Was there any childhood holiday that was fun that you did enjoy and that inspired you to travel a bit, or was the Southwold ones better than they look on film?
Well, no, I think you might be referring to a play that I wrote called East of Ipswich, which was a fiction, but it was based on the holidays we had, but it was kind of deliberately playing up the most sort of daunting aspects of it, like the Joan Sanderson as the landlady. And we're all having breakfast one day, and she comes in. No, they were having breakfast one day. This was entirely based on my dad staying at one of those rather nasty guest houses, and he had a bit of a problem with constipation, so I had to have grape nuts for breakfast in the morning. And I remember him asking the landlady, you know, can you do some grape nuts? Grape nuts, yes, we'll get some grape nuts. Very loudly, I think, being embarrassing. And then the next morning we're all there, and suddenly everyone's eating their breakfast rather quietly. Who wanted the grape nuts? Grape nuts? Ah, yes, over there. You know. So I played that up a bit. Actually, the holidays, I love the holidays. I love going to the sea. Sheffield felt an awful long way from the sea. I've always loved even the grey North Sea. So Southwell wasn't that bad. But, you know, just places like that made me want to travel even further. It was like when I grew up in Sheffield, going to Nottingham was a big treat. And I thought there must be somewhere beyond Nottingham, you know, Mansfield, somewhere like that. You know. So there's always somewhere else to go. The moving was the main thing.
Question over here, if we may.
Thank you. Of all your travels, where would you say you've been where you think the people seem most content?
Well, people have asked me this before, and again, it's hard to know from one's own perception, but there's a place called the Hunza Valley right up in northern Pakistan. And it's village life up there, and a lot of villages that we came to, the young were all leaving and going off to the city. And in these little villages, high up on the northwest frontier, people stayed, families stayed together. There was quite a sort of well-organized community. The Aga Khan, I think, was the sort of... He was the head of that particular branch of the of Muslim religion. And it all seemed to work very, very well. And I remember, usually in villages, they were a bit sort of... You used to feel a bit sorry for people. They were dusty, they were a bit grim, they didn't have electricity, all that sort of thing that we take for granted. But up there, they were very well looked after. And the fields were tilled very well, and it was obviously a tough life, but a very rewarding life. And they seemed extraordinarily happy.
I think we've probably got time for one more question, if we've got a burning one there.
Hi, Michael. Pleasure to meet you. I just wondered if you've been tempted to learn any of the languages of the countries that you've been in, or have you picked up any sort of choice expressions that you could share?
No, I'm not very good at languages, really, and I've never really mastered anything. I mean, just about get by in French. My excuse was that we were going to so many countries that there was no chance of learning all the languages all the way along. So you just learn, you know, thank you, please, thank you, one beer, please, and I'm English, I'm sorry. That was a very good phrase. But that was it. A source of great regret that I admire people. Do you speak languages yourself? I can't hear because I haven't got the mic. But anyway, it would have made things easier, but it was impossible given the number of countries. But it's very, very important because you really can't get much below the surface without knowing the language. The good thing is that you can be somewhere in some restaurant, some bar, and it's much more comfortable than being in a restaurant or a bar here, where people might say, is that Michael Palin over there or whatever? They'll just be talking away, and you're completely oblivious. You don't understand that they're saying, who's that complete idiot over there? Isn't that silly twat from Monty Python or whatever? You don't know they're saying that. You think they're just talking about the weather. And so there are advantages to not knowing languages, but very few. Many more advantages to knowing the language, yeah.
Wow, thank you very much for your time and for coming to Stanford.
It's gone so quickly.
It's been lovely. The good news is that Michael is going to be doing a limited signing over at the Stanford's stand, and there are also pre-signed books that he's been busy out back scribbling, haven't you?
Yeah.
There's the diaries, there's all the range of travel books pretty much, and some other bits and pieces. So do go and have a look in the bookshop. People are racing to get there ahead of you, Michael. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks for some great questions. Thank you, Michael Palin.
Thank you.